From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Meet the guy with Trump's ear.
Stephen Bannon, a former Goldman Sachs banker who served on the Trump campaign, will serve as chief strategist and senior counselor to the president.
Wait a minute. Goldman Sachs isn't the part of Steve Bannon's resume that sparked the rage petitions and protests over his appointment this week? No, not that.
Bannon's Breitbart News website is a favorite of extremists and white nationalists.
A platform for the alt-right movement, an amalgam of white nationalism, misogyny, and anti-Semitism.
With such headlines as this, "Hoisted high and proud, the Confederate flag proclaims a glorious heritage. Gabby Giffords, the gun control movement's human shield. Data, young Muslims in the West are a ticking time bomb."
And don't forget the headline, "Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy." Bannon himself has called Breitbart News a platform for the so-called alt-right. But he and other Breitbart staffers claim there's a distinction between providing a venue for them and personally harboring their views. Here's Breitbart editor-at-large Joel Pollack.
Breitbart is not a white nationalist site. Steve Bannon is not an anti-Semite. Just the usual smears. And the left, of course, is still in tantrum mode after losing the election.
Well, I think Breitbart sees itself fundamentally differently than the outside world sees it.
Joshua Green is senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek. He profiled Steve Bannon last year.
Breitbart fancies itself as being this kind of rogue operation that is political, but it is also on a cultural mission to point out double standards and hypocrisies in the media, the different sorts of language we use to talk about black culture, Muslim religion, women and gender issues, as distinct from how we talk about white people and white ethnicity. That it's broadly accepted to say Black Lives Matter, but it's not okay to celebrate, you know, what they perceive to be white cultural heritage and raise the Confederate flag. But there's another part of what they're doing, too, and that is intentionally trying to provoke and upset and offend people in order to stoke grassroots anger at the government, at the broader culture, and funnel them behind Donald Trump's candidacy, which helped him knock off everybody else in the Republican field and got him elected president of the United States.
In your piece in 2015 about Bannon, you describe him as a sort of Jekyll and Hyde character, and he had a two-pronged approach to influencing the media and politics. One, the Mr. Hyde route, and then there was another route which reflects the Dr. Jekyll side, but start with Mr. Hyde.
Well, Hyde basically was Breitbart News, which became Bannon's avenue to reach angry populist conservatives and kind of whip them into a frenzy in opposition to Hillary Clinton, and also on a specific issue set to drive right-wing talk radio coverage and to influence Republicans in Congress. What Breitbart does that is really interesting is write about the news in a way that to me recalled the early 20th century press barons. They used to cover the news almost as a drama, as this ongoing rolling story with heroes and villains. And that's the way that Breitbart covers things. They pick certain issues. And one of those issues was Hillary Clinton. They were priming the conservative audience to be upset and paranoid and frightened and angry about Hillary Clinton.
What's the Dr. Jekyll side?
Well, so the Dr. Jekyll side is interesting because it stems from a Bannon theory that the reason conservatives failed in the 1990s is that people stopped listening to them. If you remember, there were all these wild conspiracy theories that the Clintons were murderers and drug runners, and it actually filtered up into Congress and into the House of Representatives. It actually went out and did an investigation to determine whether or not Vince Foster, the deputy White House counsel who tragically committed suicide, had in fact been murdered by the Clintons. And they did this by taking, I can't remember if it was a pumpkin or a watermelon, into the backyard and shooting it with a pistol, which was intended to provide something. And that was kind of the moment when the whole anti-Clinton conspiracy stuff in the 90s jumped the shark, and any mainstream media outlet and news organization essentially at that point tuned them out.
Right.
And so Bannon's diagnosis was that, well, if we're going to stop the next Clinton from getting to the White House, we're going to have to arm ourselves with actual facts and research and not just nutty conspiracy theories. And Bannon's great insight was that if you could produce this stuff, you could hand it off to mainstream media investigative reporters, and they would take what you'd given them and go report it out and produce stories that would then appear on the front pages of papers like the New York Times and like the Washington Post. His Dr. Jekyll side is he is the head of a nonprofit research organization based in Tallahassee, Florida, called the Government Accountability Institute, which publishes books and reports that essentially shed light on what it considers to be cronyism in politics and business.
The Government Accountability Institute is responsible for the book Clinton Cash, which investigated donations made by foreign governments to the Clinton Foundation and paid speeches made by the Clintons. And you wrote that it probably did more to shape public perception of Hillary Clinton than any of the barbs from her Republican detractors.
Well, absolutely. So the book appeared in the spring of 2015, just as Clinton was getting ready to run for president. And what it did was it essentially seized the media narrative. There was kind of an iconic front page New York Times investigation by Joe Becker that looked at Clinton's connection to, I believe it was like a
Canadian mining magnate who gave tens of millions to the foundation and then flew Bill to Kazakhstan on his plane.
Exactly. And it all looked very odd and shady and just not the kind of behavior you'd expect Clinton to be involved in. And then there were other stories popping up in other news outlets. I don't think Clinton knew quite how to react because it didn't fit the profile of the type of scandal and attack that the Clintons were used to dealing with, because there was real research and reporting undergirding these stories. And if you look at Clinton's approval ratings over that spring, what you see is her unfavorable ratings start to climb up, 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 up. You know, down at the Government Accountability Institute, he essentially had this group of researchers, of investigators digging for this stuff. But he also had a fascinating guy named Winton Hall, who is a former Donald Trump ghostwriter. He would storyboard the anti-Clinton articles he was hoping to place in various outlets, almost the way you would pitch a Hollywood movie.
You quote Winton Hall saying, "Anchor left, pivot right."
Exactly. And that comes straight from Bannon's belief that it is a waste of time to take this good reporting and put it in a right-wing media outlet like Breitbart News. There's much more value in placing this story in what they call the left, in what you and I would call the mainstream media, like the New York Times, the Washington Post. And then the way that the two sides of Bannon worked in synergy was, well, now you have these stories on the front page on the evening news, and Breitbart can pick up its rolling narrative about how terrible and nefarious Hillary Clinton is. But instead of just making these claims, they're pointing to, look, the New York Times says so. Look, 60 Minutes has a package on this. And lo and behold, Bannon basically orchestrated an elaborate plan to deny Hillary Clinton the presidency that succeeded.
You spoke to him recently, right?
To Bannon?
Yeah.
Yeah, I spoke to him the morning after the election. I was interested in what is Trump going to do as president and what is Trumpism going to look like. His answer, which I thought was sort of interesting and revealing, he said, this is not the French Revolution. The French destroyed the basic institutions of their society, beheaded all the leaders. You know, what Trump represents is a restoration of true American capitalism.
He said at one point, I'm a Leninist. Lenin wanted to destroy the state, and that's my goal, too. So if he says it isn't the French Revolution, does he wish it were?
When Bannon talks about being a Leninist, wanting to tear things down, what he's speaking of specifically is the political establishment. He talks a lot about cronyism, about how Republican ideals have been corrupted. The same bogeyman described by people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, the fact that, you know, politicians and banks have become too complicit and corrupt. The elites get all the upside. Working and middle-class Americans get none of it. You know, we want to restore that balance. We want to drain the swamp.
If you have Reince Priebus whispering in your ear to get along with Paul Ryan and those establishment ideas, and then in the other ear you have Steve Bannon saying, this is the biggest problem, you got to blow this stuff up.
You know, just in my own reporting in the month or so before the election, I'm told that internally Bannon was one of the voices telling Trump, you know, don't go out on the stump and pick these fights with Paul Ryan. And the people who were encouraging Trump in those pursuits were actually members of Trump's extended family who were kind of resentful that Ryan was behaving as condescendingly, I think, as they thought he was toward Trump. You know, it doesn't automatically hold that just because he was a bomb thrower on the outside that Bannon will be a bomb thrower on the inside too. But, you know, that being said, that is certainly his MO and his personality.
Apparently one of his mantras is facts get shares, opinions get shrugs. Since Bannon's going to have a lot of facts at his disposal when he's in the White House, do you think that the strategies that he's used thus far to influence the media and politics will play out in this new role?
Well, potentially they could. And when you step back and think about all the information that Trump and Bannon will have access to with their security clearances, that's a bit of a scary thought. But certainly the lesson of Trump's plot to take down Hillary is that facts can succeed in tearing down enemies and achieving political goals. And you'd have to expect on some level that would be a lesson they would try to apply to governing as well.
Josh, thank you very much.
No, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Joshua Green is senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek. His profile of Steve Bannon is called, "This Man is the Most Dangerous Political Operative in America."
Coming up, like it or not, the alt-right now has a seat at the table.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Steve Bannon has come under fire because of his ties to the alt-right, the cohort that lurks on Breitbart News and trades in racist memes and segregationist aspirations. And given that the alt-right was part of the movement that vaulted Donald Trump into office and has now found purchase inside the White House itself, Hillary Clinton's memorable campaign tutorial has taken on a new edge.
Now, alt-right is short for alternative right. The Wall Street Journal describes it as a loose but organized movement, mostly online, that rejects mainstream conservatism, promotes nationalism, and views immigration and multiculturalism as threats to white identity. So the de facto merger between Breitbart and the Trump campaign represents a landmark achievement for this group, a fringe element that has effectively taken over the Republican Party.
But reactionaryism comes in a variety of flavors. New Yorker writer Andrew Marantz says that white nationalism is just one of four strains of the alt-right.
So the people who were most vocal about calling themselves alt-right in the beginning were, in fact, white nationalists. Richard Spencer, Jared Taylor, I mean, the list goes on. A lot of those people are very open about their ideology, which is about protecting white power. That is a small but vocal core of people who affiliate with the alt-right, which then over the last 5 or so years spread out to include what I would call three other categories in addition to the, you know, white supremacist category, which would be just nihilistic chaos agent internet trolls.
Anonymous vandal bullies, for the most part, just trying to get a rise out of folks?
Right. So that would be the second category, which is what you could call pure trolls. The pure trolls don't really seem to have an agenda. The third would be more sort of anti-feminist people who coalesced around Gamergate and similar things who just really want women to stop telling them what to say.
It's not just feeling that feminism has emasculated American men. It's really kind of ultra-sexism. They seem to be angry that they cannot treat women as mere prey.
Yeah, you see a lot of just real vitriol at any woman who doesn't look the way that these men think a woman should look. You saw that with the actress Leslie Jones. You know, you saw a good amount of it with Hillary Clinton.
But there's another jar, huh?
The fourth one would be the conspiracist jar.
The Alex Jones paranoid wingnuttery crowd.
Right. And once you have fully built your own reality field, which again is something that Trump has successfully done again and again, you can say whatever you want.
Now, are these odd jar fellows, or are they linked arm in arm and marching heroically into the future?
Well, they are certainly on the same march when it comes to Trump support. So for the past few months, you've seen them really sort of united in a common cause. But they are, in some sense, strange bedfellows. There are some people who really primarily care about borders and keeping America a European heritage zone. And those people may or may not buy into, you know, a conspiracy about fluoride in the tap water.
If I understand this right, the alt-right's means of stirring things up has something to do with media outlets like Breitbart, but it has more to do with how it operates in social media. There's a formula. And you did a profile on one of the mad scientists who has perfected the formula, a guy named Mike Cernovich.
He had built up a following independent of anything political as a kind of self-help fitness writer.
And pickup artist.
Yes, and pickup artist and part of the manosphere. This guy, Mike Cernovich, is a mid-level amplifier. He only has 150,000 or so Twitter followers, but he really is able to mobilize them and harness their passion to drive essentially any story he wants.
For example, the notion that Hillary Clinton, during the course of the campaign, had some sort of undisclosed major health disorder, completely invented from whole cloth.
Right. Well, at first invented from whole cloth. He sort of looked at the tea leaves and said, I do not want this woman to be president. What can I, as a completely independent figure in my living room in Orange County, California, what can I do to affect the outcome of this election? And he mobilized that audience to say, look, we're not going to have an argument about Clinton's policies. We're going to go after her appearance and her health. That was his preferred persuasion tactic. It was a months-long campaign to create the perception that she was frail or ill. And when she did turn out to have pneumonia, when there was actual video footage of her actually fainting at a 9/11 memorial, he was like, did I create that?
And he repeats these memes until they enter the conversation among the diehards on social media, and then, not coincidentally, into the cogs of the great right-wing media conspiracy, Matt Drudge, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Breitbart, and so on. How does he do that? What's the mechanism?
I went out and spent a few days with him in California and watched him over his shoulder as he does his daily routine on his laptop. And he told me, you know, when I decided I wanted to break into the news, I had to study how news cycles work. And what I do have is Twitter. And I know that if I can get a hashtag to start trending, then it ipso facto becomes something that people feel that they have to pay attention to. He got his core base of people, and it really doesn't have to be more than a couple thousand people. He'll rally them on Periscope, which is a video streaming app. He'll tell them, you know, in a sort of conversational way with them sort of responding by typed comments in real time, here's what's going on today. There was this bombing. How are we going to spin this bombing in New York? Turns it into a really pithy, kind of catchy hashtag.
It's a troll war room.
Right. And it's very open. What he's doing is trying to meme these stories into the conversation. And he has very specific targets. Brian Stelter on CNN and Chris Cillizza at The Washington Post. And to take Chris Cillizza as an example, he had written in The Washington Post, why are we even talking about Hillary's health? This is not an issue. And then 2 days later, he said, Hillary's health just became an issue in this campaign. And that was exactly the result they were seeking.
As you've looked at other people's coverage of the alt-right to date, do we misunderstand what is afoot here?
Yeah, I've seen some coverage that I thought missed the boat a little bit. I mean, there's some false equivalence stuff. There's also some basic assumption that alt-right just means to the right of whatever the mainstream Republicans say, when, in fact, a lot of these positions don't line up neatly on a political spectrum. And then I think it also sometimes misses the degree to which the purveyors of these memes are constantly shifting how serious they are. You know, often when they're called to account for something they've said or passed on or retweeted, they say, oh, that was just a joke. Why can't you get a thicker skin? One of my favorite exchanges was Trump goes out at a rally and says Obama's the founder of ISIS. Then CNN reports that he said that Obama was the founder of ISIS. Then he tweets, does CNN not get sarcasm? And then he goes on Hugh Hewitt's radio show the next day and Hugh Hewitt says, so you were being sarcastic? And he says, no, Obama was the founder of ISIS. So the slipperiness of tone, I think, is something that a lot of people have missed. You know, they'll point to one thing that someone has written or said or posted and say, this is your ideology. This is what you believe. You believe that Pepe the Nazi frog should be in charge of the White House or whatever. A lot of these things are not deeply held beliefs, especially with the more sort of pure troll end of the spectrum. They are throwing spanners in the works and just kind of seeing what happens.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Marantz is on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. The alt-right and others who've proudly co-opted the deplorable title conferred by Hillary Clinton see in Trump's elevation an unprecedented opportunity, like former Ku Klux Klan imperial wizard David Duke.
I will be Donald Trump's most loyal advocate to make sure his nominees go to the Supreme Court.
And head of the American Nazi Party, Rocky Sujeda.
If Trump does win, it's going to be a real opportunity for people like white nationalists to build upon that. Okay, you know how you have the black political caucus and whatnot, all right, again, in Congress and everything? Building on something like that.
And Jared Taylor, avowed white separatist and founder and editor of American Renaissance.
That is Donald Trump's great achievement, to have been the standard bearer, even if unconsciously, of white interests. The sleeping giant has been stirring for some time, and Mr. Trump gave it a voice and a reason to act.
The Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence report calls Taylor, quote, the cultivated cosmopolitan face of white supremacy, the guy who provides the, quote, intellectual heft to modern-day Klansmen. Taylor calls himself a race realist, and as such believes that blacks are less intelligent than whites, whites are less intelligent than East Asians, and that the races are driven by nature to segregate. And we're having him on the show. Why? Because, like it or not, Taylor and his kind have moved just a little closer to the seat of power. And so all Americans, especially those who are repulsed by the likes of him, would do well to learn something about his policy proposals. To know him is not to normalize him. Here's the interview. Do you now have, or expect to have, as a result of this election, a seat at the grown-up table in the Trump coalition?
If invited, I will take my place, but I'm not holding my breath. I don't think Trump sees the world in racial terms. I think he has a basic sense of fairness, however.
I got to tell you a story. Back in, I guess it was the early 90s, Sonny Bono was elected to Congress, and I spent the day with him on his day of swearing in and so forth. And while I was waiting for him in the foyer of his new congressional office, there was this other guy standing there, blue blazer, gray flannel pants, name badge on, and it finally dawned on me that the guy was from the National Rifle Association. And I said to him, well, what's the NRA doing here? And he said, this is a paraphrase, but it's pretty accurate. He said, I just wanted to remind the congressman who brought him to Washington. Now, you're a guest on this program because we responded to your press release. And I'm wondering, is that what your media availability is all about, reminding the president-elect who got him to Washington?
Not necessarily. It is to point out a certain dynamic in this election, which is different from that of other elections. For perhaps the first time, it seems that white people are voting the way every other group votes. In other words, they're voting in their own interests. We all take it for granted that blacks, Hispanics, Asians, they have legitimate group interests, and they can push for them as hard as they can. But as soon as you start asking, well, do white people have legitimate group interests? Well, then no, you're a Nazi. You're a white supremacist. You're a very, very bad person. And I think many white voters react at a visceral level to policies that are in the interests of whites, and that's absolutely as it should be.
In terms of your goals as a movement, what would you like to see happen next? I mean, a roundup of undocumented Mexicans, a bar against Muslim immigration. Those are two ideas that Trump campaigned on.
Those are very important steps. But to me, the ultimate goal is to have at least a portion of the United States where whites are the recognized majority and in which their culture is recognized as the dominant culture and where they can live free from the embrace of people unlike themselves. And I believe that that can be achieved through voluntary separation. The government today is doing its best to try to force people together.
You know, Plessy Ferguson is no longer the law of the land. What about equal rights under the law?
Don't I have the right to move to a place that's whiter, that's more to my liking? Don't I have that right?
I can tell you explicitly that the law says you do not get to have a say in where other people live.
Of course not.
Well, I don't know if you are, in fact, at the grown-up table, but you certainly are in the room at this point.
Well, as we should be.
What is your strategy now that you've arrived there?
Ideally, the ideas of racial dissidents such as myself will increasingly become mainstream and be recognized for the correct understanding of human nature that they are. Eventually, if my people and my culture are to survive in some meaningful way, these ideas have to spread.
Well, we have equal protection under the law. We have anti-discrimination laws, which have been repeatedly upheld by the Supreme Court. Is it your intention to rewrite the Constitution?
The Civil Rights Act of 1964 is not part of the Constitution. Until the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it was perfectly legal for a private operator to discriminate in his place of business, in his choice of associates. It was perfectly legal for people to band together and establish communities in which they would agree not to sell their property to anyone other than people like themselves. I think that is an expression of freedom of association, free choice. I'm not talking about the government or monopolists. Private individuals should have the right to discriminate for good reasons, bad reasons, or no reasons at all.
I think it's entirely the premise of a number of social justice and identity politics movements that the last group that needs protection in our society is white people, because that's where all the power resides, the political power, economic power. You know who Louis C.K. is?
Louis C.K.? No, don't know who that is.
Well, he's a very prominent stand-up comedian.
Okay.
And he does a bit.
Lucky guy. I got a lot going for me. I'm healthy. I'm relatively young. I'm white, which thank God for that, boy. That is a huge leg up. Are you kidding me? But let me be clear, by the way. I'm not saying that white people are better. I'm saying that being white is clearly better. Who could even argue? If it was an option, I would re-up every year. Oh, yeah, I'll take white again. Absolutely. I've been enjoying that.
He is making a joke about the manifest reality of being a minority in a society that still has a lot of repair work to do.
Tell me something. If white society is so oppressive to non-whites, why is it that millions of them want to come and continue to come?
For political freedom and economic opportunity. Just as every European immigrant group came in the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, for exactly the same reason.
And so they're coming despite the fact that we treat them so miserably, and yet somehow they can have better economic opportunity here. How do you explain that if we so hate them and despise them?
Right. I want to thank you for coming onto the show.
Okay. You really have a closed mind. I feel sorry for you, really. You are unable to look around you and see the double standards, the contradictions, the facts. But I hope you're happy in your ignorance.
White nationalist Jared Taylor is founder and editor of American Renaissance.
Coming up, fake news really took off this election, especially on social media, where most people get their news.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week abounded with stories of fake news.
People who got their election news on Facebook might have been looking at more fake stories than real ones.
When it comes to news, not everything in our feed is legit.
If it makes me laugh, then I might share it if it's very interesting.
Google and Facebook are responding to accusations that fake news influenced the outcome of the election and fueled divisiveness across the country.
Craig Silverman of BuzzFeed looked at the top fake election stories that performed best on Facebook, that is, had the most likes and shares, and compared them with the 20 top-performing real news stories. He found that in the 3 months leading up to Election Day, the top fake election stories generated more engagement on Facebook than the top real news stories. Of the top five fake stories on BuzzFeed's list, four were anti-Clinton, with headlines like WikiLeaks confirms Hillary sold weapons to ISIS, and one was pro-Trump, about Pope Francis endorsing him for president. In contrast, the stories from real news sites that prompted the most Facebook reactions tended to favor Hillary Clinton. Silverman covers hoaxes and online misinformation for BuzzFeed, and he concedes that the sample was limited by the data he could glean from Facebook.
Certainly, we're not claiming that in total, fake news sites and fake news beat out mainstream news, because obviously there's a huge amount of mainstream news, and fake news sites put out daily stuff, but not at the same pace. And so by specifying that it's viral, we're really talking about the top 20 hits from the fake sites and fake stories versus top 20 from about 19 mainstream news organizations.
Okay. Now, you had a chart that showed right around Election Day, the fake news got a lot more engagement than the real news, which would lead any casual observer to think that it was being consumed at a greater rate.
Well, it was definitely being engaged with at a greater rate. And this is where we have to be really clear about what Facebook gives us and what it doesn't give us. We know that the fake stories, we're getting more comments, more reactions, more shares in total. We don't know, for example, that they necessarily got more traffic. In fact, it's probably safe to assume that those mainstream sites, which are, you know, very big and have loyal audiences, were still getting bigger traffic, even though their bigger stories were getting less engagement on Facebook. And that was one of the like really surprising things to me. One part is the spike in engagements for fake news when you get into that, you know, August until Election Day period. But at the same time, from February through till Election Day, the trend line on engagements for those top stories from mainstream outlets was consistently going down, and I don't really know why there was such a decline. What are some of the possibilities? Well, one of them is just simply were the stories that they were reporting just not as interesting to people on Facebook. Another one that people have raised, and that's really impossible for us to know, is that in about the middle of the summer, Facebook did announce a change to its newsfeed algorithm where it was aimed at surfacing more kind of personal updates and personal news to people. And, you know, there was a decline after that.
The algorithm changed. Why?
What Facebook said is that for the news feed, rather than having it totally dominated by, you know, news articles and content from outside sites, they wanted to tweak the algorithm to make sure that people were getting the updates from their friends and family members and others that were really important in their personal life.
Right. And that may very well have diminished the stream to Facebook of legitimate news sites.
You would think a tweak like that might affect, you know, mainstream news as well as fake news, because they would all fall into the category, to a certain extent at least, of being news. And that's why I want to be cautious about assuming that that was a factor or a big factor. You know, we know that Facebook is the biggest driver of audience that there is. It's bigger than Google now. And so when Facebook tweaks its algorithm and a reduction in the engagement for these top 20 hits started to really take hold, inevitably, I think people in media are going to look at that and speculate about it.
Well, given that Facebook tweaked its algorithm to make it more responsive to people's personal networks and their personal interests, rather than things coming in sort of over the transom, and that heightened engagement with fake news, do you see this as a media problem, a Facebook problem, or a human problem?
Maybe it'll sound like a cop-out, but I'm going to check all three boxes. I think that at the core of this, there's complexity. You know, I've been seeing some people saying that, oh, fake news gave Trump the election. And we have no evidence to support that. He probably won for a variety of reasons. And fake news spreading is probably doing so for a variety of reasons. We've always had hoaxes. We've always had misinformation. The introduction of Facebook and the scale that it has, there's more than 1.7 billion people around the world who log into Facebook every month. Combining that with the natural human behavior where we love information that confirms what we think and believe, but like to stay away from stuff that doesn't. I mean, you put the human behavior with the platform, with the tendency for misinformation that's always been there. And I think we have an environment that is rooted in what's been going on for a long time, but is different because of how big the platform is.
Craig, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is a reporter with BuzzFeed News.
Now, just under 45% of Americans get their news from Facebook. But Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg insisted that 99% of what they see on the site is authentic, and that it was, quote, crazy to say that it could have swung the election. But that said, he vowed to make changes. John Herman covers the media for The New York Times. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Facebook and Google announced that they'd each prevent fake news websites from getting access to their ad networks, trying to starve them of the revenue they need to keep in business. How does that work, and will it work?
So for Google to ban a site from AdSense can have a real effect. AdSense can be used to promote a website, as in a website owner or a news site owner could promote their content on AdSense. But more probably, AdSense is used to put ads on the website, to put ads under the lies, if that's what you're publishing. For Google to knock people out of that ecosystem is definitely a hit. Facebook publishers don't tend to make money that way. The small, hyper-partisan Facebook pages, they lead to outside websites. They use Facebook to gather people. They don't use Facebook to make money from those people. For that, they might use Google on their website, or more likely, they'll use sort of a low-rent ad network, the boxes under articles with skincare tips and conspiracy theories and stuff like that.
Meantime, I'm just curious by what means anybody expects Facebook actually to, first of all, monitor the entirety of what's shared on its platform. It's not as though they have thousands and thousands of fact checkers. They don't. What would it have to do to intervene in order to keep the phony stuff out of the system?
There are things that Facebook could do to address this problem as it's been narrowly defined. They could take outside links to websites that have reached a certain number of shares, have an editorial team apply some sort of scrutiny to those things, and then eventually penalize the sites that they're coming from if they're repeat offenders. This is possible. They could likewise rely on a sort of user reporting framework like they do for harassment, or, you know, if we're going to compare it to another giant online marketplace, an eBay rating system. The editorial team, the sort of internal Snopes, is something that could be applied to things that look like news or purport to be news articles. These are all things they could do. It would give Facebook the ability to sort of close off this conversation and say, we've done something, while next to those articles, you have image memes that contain false information that have been shared a million plus times that don't claim to be news articles, but they claim to tell you facts. Videos that have been shared millions of times that contain obvious falsehoods. Maybe they have little chyrons on the bottom. Do those then come under the umbrella of the news administration or news moderation team? There are just the endless sorts of almost fake, almost news that such a solution wouldn't have to touch, and that these proposed solutions don't really ask it to touch. And so I do feel like the fake news discussion, as it narrows down onto the sites that look like news sites, that publish stories, I feel like that could be leading us into kind of a cul-de-sac.
So how do we get back onto the highway? Do you have any ideas as to what Facebook or separately Google or Twitter can do to keep its users from being deceived or worse?
I don't mean to suggest that this is impossible. I just mean to suggest that that conversation is one that we really haven't started to have. The big conversation is about Facebook's accountability in the vast spaces in which it operates. And Zuckerberg's initial response, the most defiant response, was saying it's absurd to call us a media company just because there's news on our platform, or an aerospace company because we're flying drones, or a B2B company because we sell software to businesses. And yet I think the challenge to this and the challenge for this whole discussion is to ask why that's absurd. Why, and this needs to be defended, is Facebook not simply all of those things?
So wherever you turn in the last few days, the conversation is fake news, fake news, fake news, kind of closing the barn door after the cow has fled. How is it that we weren't hip to this and sounding the alarms, oh, I don't know, 6 weeks ago?
A lot had been written about the subject, and also anyone who used Facebook could have easily intuited that a lot of what they're seeing was coming from sources that might not be credible, but in each specific instance might be borderline absurd. This was sort of part of the broader problem of people simply not believing that one candidate could win over the other. It made fake news into a curiosity or a worry. Only now, in retrospect, is it being seen widely as this deep problem.
John, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
John Herman is a reporter for The New York Times.
Drawing a distinction between fake and real news is going to be hard for those Facebook and Google employees tasked with bird-dogging offending sites. But it shouldn't be so hard for you, the consumer. Melissa Zimdars, professor of communication and media at Merrimack College, has made a list of more than 100 problematic news sites, along with tips for sorting out the truthful from the troublesome. She got into the fake news sorting racket after a hot tip.
Someone alerted me to the fact that when you searched for the popular vote on Google, the first Google news item that came up was a fake news website saying that Hillary Clinton lost the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I was like, yeah, we need to teach our students how to navigate this.
Tell me what the reaction's been to the doc.
I received hundreds of emails saying, oh, this made me think about a particular website that I go to a lot. Maybe I need to read more broadly. Or some people said, yeah, I've been concerned about this website too. But I will say, in the last 24 hours, the tide has turned a little bit. A lot of the websites on the list are now encouraging their readers to send me information about how they feel. And so now there's been sort of an onslaught of personally negative commentary from them.
So you're getting trolled.
Majorly trolled, yes.
In fact, hasn't Breitbart and other websites fingered you as a target in the latter part of this week?
They most definitely have. I seem to have become the poster child for censorship and for rejecting alternative points of view in favor of the media, in quotes.
Mm-hmm. You have basically lumped a bunch of these fake news sites or semi-fake news sites into four categories. Flat-out fake is number one. Reports in a way that's connected to the truth but lacks context quotes, verifiability is two. Three is just plain clickbait. Four is satire, and of course, some of them can be all of those things. Part of the reason why you've gotten legitimate pushback is because satire sites don't want to be on a list marked fake.
Yeah, but I will say, actually, several satire websites sent me links to their list saying, we don't want to be confused as actual news. You should add us to the list. I think satire is fantastic. I think it serves a really important political and social purpose. But satire can also be misunderstood and has been, and a lot of communication studies show this.
Well, how do you account for the fact that clickbait is increasingly becoming a practice among reputable news sources that put a headline which could very well be misleading, like one in the Huffington Post, Bernie Sanders could replace President Trump with little-known loophole?
Yeah, and what's crazy about that example is it was meant to teach people about clickbait headlines and verifying their sources, but undoubtedly that got shared by people who only read the headline.
Now, you characterize Breitbart as a two and a three. Tell me why.
So a three is often because they rely on hyperbole. Just scrolling through a lot of their headlines. There seems to be sometimes a disconnect even between the headline and the article. But they've also published a lot of stuff during the election that isn't really verifiable. And really good journalists have looked at that coverage, especially now that Bannon is part of Trump's team. I think it kind of vacillates between stuff grounded in truth that's potentially informing to readers of the website, but other content that does a disservice to their readers.
So let's get to the sites that are downright false. This was probably the most useful part of the list for me. How can you identify them?
Their web design, you can almost always tell, all caps, exaggerated, photoshopped visuals, and oftentimes just by their strange domain names. So instead of msnbc.com, you have msnbc.com.co.
You said we should avoid websites that end in L-O, as in newslow.
Yeah, that tip came from a blogger by the name of Ed Brayton. You know, these sites might have a bit of accuracy to them, but they're usually detextualized or contain otherwise false or misleading facts.
Then there are the things that are cleverly designed to mislead, like an old article circulating as if it's breaking news.
The first thing to do when you open something that interests you is to look immediately at the date.
What do you do about the in-between sites like BuzzFeed community posts or Forbes blogs? They're certainly not fact-checked, but they do exist under the banner of legitimate organizations.
Exactly. And I think that makes it more difficult for people to navigate because they see the Forbes logo and they assume it's going through the same editing process. So I feel like there needs to be greater awareness than buried at the bottom of the post that this was submitted by a reader or a blogger unaffiliated or employed by those websites.
Probably the single most helpful hint you've given readers is to do a gut check. If this story makes you really angry, it's probably a good idea to keep reading about the topic on other sources.
Yeah, these stories can make you really angry through capital letters, through the types of terms they use, like so-and-so will destroy Donald Trump or whatever it may be. These sources are definitely coming from a certain perspective. Persuasive opinion writing isn't a problem, but when it's framed as more neutral or objective style reporting, that's when there's a problem.
And you suggest that it wouldn't hurt to check the About Us tab on the website?
If you can find one, sometimes when you're on these sites, it's very difficult to figure out even who's publishing the website. So if there is an About Us tab, definitely check it. Otherwise, see if there's Wikipedia pages, see if other websites have reported on them. But I think part of the problem is a lot of people whose messages in these websites, even if they find another website saying that that information or the website is false, they might think that these other critical websites are just trying to prevent the truth from coming out.
Yeah, but the thing is that if you keep digging, if you really care enough to get beyond your own confirmation bias, you can come to the truth.
Totally. And I think all of the discussion about fake news, it is at the very least generating a discussion. I even have family members texting me that they had never thought about this before and now they feel like they will pay attention more to what they're circulating. And most of the emails I receive echo the same sentiment. And that's the goal.
We're going to post a link to your Google Doc and on themedia.org. And Melissa, I want to thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa Zimdars is a professor of communication and media at Merrimack College. You can find a link to the Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Fake News Edition at our website, onthemedia.org.co. Just kidding. Just onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Paige Cowett. We had more help from Micah Loewinger, Sara Kari, and Leia Fetter, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.